Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world of economics and politics. And we've got the usual two segments lined up tonight. First, in about 7 minutes or so, we'll speak with Joel Magnuson, who's the author of a relatively new book called Mindful Economics, How the U.S. Economy Works, Why It Matters, and How It Could Be Different. I'm often asked what to read as a kind of introduction to economics as a discipline, but also an overview of the state of the economy, except whatever exactly that is. And I used to be kind of stumped by that question, but now one of the things I would say is read Joel Magnuson's Mindful Economics, and we'll talk to him about his thinking and the book and the state of things today, which is, of course, rather interesting. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll talk with producers of a work in progress, a documentary in progress on student debt. They need some help raising funds to finish the project, but we'll talk to them about what they've found so far. And you can see a trailer for their movie on the web, and we'll have all those details just after the half hour. That's Aurora Menengello and Serge Bakilian. They will be with us to talk about the problem of student debt, which is quite a problem. Most people graduating now with enormous debts that they have to pay back at high and unforgiving interest rates, and with no prospect for bankruptcy, no consumer protections, nothing. One of the most unprotected forms of consumer credit around, and really a crime when education should be free, shouldn't it? Okay, some words first on the economic news before we get on with the interviews. More of the same, more or less. The economy continues to stink, and not just in the U.S. German industrial production, for example, is in a free fall. In fact, the European economy looks to be declining faster than ours. Yet most European governments are showing little interest in a bigger stimulus program, despite U.S. pressure to step up. We'll see how long that resistance continues. Christian Friedland, the U.S. Editor of the Financial Times, had an interesting piece in that paper on Thursday, arguing that even though the economic crisis originated in the U.S., and it looks like it might end up with Asia gaining relative to us, at least in economic terms, there's unlikely to be any serious challenge to U.S. political leadership, or imperial power, if you prefer the older language, which I do, in the coming years. The European Union has no political coherence and has been engaging in some pretty heavy infighting about how to handle this crisis and whether to bail out the eastern portion of the continent, whose economies are in miserable shape. Meanwhile, the U.S. is under energetic new leadership, not what I'd like to see, of course, but there's no denying the force of Barack Obama's intelligence and political skill. And despite being the origin of the global crisis, and despite having to borrow trillions of dollars to bail out the financial sector and stimulate the economy, there's no sign of global investors shunning U.S. Treasury bonds. That could all change, but obituaries for American political dominance are looking premature. That's not to say that the Obama team is firing on all cylinders. In fact, they're having a hard time even finding enough people to work for them. The Washington Post reported earlier this week that one reason the Treasury can't find good candidates to staff those positions is that no financial types want to sell their assets at current depressed prices. Now, I'm not so sure that the best place to look for good people to save and then renovate the financial system is on Wall Street. But the contrast with the New Deal era is pretty stark. Then, the Roosevelt administration was chock full of talented people willing to work for next to nothing. Not now. No doubt there are many reasons for this. Of course, the crisis was much greater then than it is now, about three times greater, you might say. But also, the intellectual and political environment in the decades leading up to the 1930s depression was a lot livelier than the past couple of decades have been here. Our present ruling elite looks mentally incompetent and morally corrupt, driven almost entirely by the accumulation of money and nothing else. Sure, they've been sort of that way for a long time, but it seems more that way than ever it was in the past. Along those lines, I've been pretty critical of Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner ever since he was nominated for the position. His closeness to Wall Street during the bubble, when he was president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, cast his qualifications for the job of the Treasury into doubt from the very beginning. His involvement in the disastrous AIG bailout and the disastrous decision to let Lehman Brothers go under reinforced those doubts. And now we have fresh reason to think that he might be exactly the wrong guy for the job. In a speech in Sydney last week, reported in the Sydney Morning Herald, former Australian Finance Minister and Prime Minister Paul Keating blamed Geithner for engineering what he called the biggest fall in GDP in the 20th century. Geithner's unlucky victim was Indonesia during the Asian crisis of 1997-98. Then he was the official in the U.S. Treasury responsible for drawing up the IMF adjustment program for that country. According to Keating's analysis, Geithner misread the problem as a current account issue and not a capital account one. That is, Geithner diagnosed the region's problems as being similar to Latin America in the 1980s and Mexico in 1994, large government and current account deficits that could be cured, though quite painfully for the local economies, through conventional austerity measures, along with an IMF loan to tide over the unlucky recipient until better times came. Keating's analysis is a little friendly to the IMF, but let's bracket that for the moment. But as Keating points out, Indonesia's public finances were in fine shape. The problem was a great inflow of hot money from abroad that had quickly turned tail and left. The result was an asset bubble followed by a rapid bust. Geithner's prescription was exactly wrong. It crashed Indonesia's economy and destroyed the IMF's credibility. That wreckage encouraged China to self-insure its economy against disaster by building up large foreign currency reserves, a crucial part of the massive imbalances plaguing the world financial system today. And as China thought that by accumulating huge stocks of dollars, if it hit hard times, it would never have to turn to the IMF. It would have plenty of money on hand to get itself through the crisis. But that massive hoard funded the U.S. credit bubble, and the rest is a very unpleasant history. And Geithner at the very center of it. In other news, the Congressional Budget Office is out with a new analysis of the distributional effects of a cap-and-trade scheme for carbon emissions. Under cap-and-trade systems of the sort the Obama administration is proposing, the government auctions off the right to emit carbon into the atmosphere. To continue pumping greenhouse gases upward, utilities, factories, and refineries and the like would have to buy up sufficient permits from the government. Over time, the allowable amounts of such permits would diminish, forcing a decline in the level of carbon emissions over time. That's the cap part. Polluters who got their emissions down below their allowed levels could then sell their surplus rights to dirtier entities. That's the trade part. The EU is already doing something like this, and it's the preferred approach of market-loving types. There are problems with these schemes. A very significant one is that the prices of carbon rights tend to be very volatile, booming in good times and crashing in bad ones, making it very difficult for companies to plan over the long term. A much neater approach would be to tax carbon at a rate that rises over time in a very stable and predictable way. In any case, the point of either a carbon tax or a cap-and-trade system is to raise the price of carbon-based fuels over time, forcing conservation and substitution. There's no easy way around that. Fossil fuels are too cheap to be compatible with life on Earth, and that has to change. That's where the CBO's distributional analysis comes in. The poorer you are, the larger of your percentage goes to energy. For example, the poorest fifth of U.S. households spend about 21% of their income on gas and utilities. Those in the middle fifth, less than half as much, 9%, and the richest, half as much again, just 4%. Obviously, any serious price increases would hit the poorest the worst. So any scheme to raise the price of fuel has to address that, has to, unless it's designed by very cruel people. The best way to do this would be through tax rebates, structured so that the poorer you are, the bigger the rebate. We shall see if Congress, the administration, does anything like that, or whether they'll take the cruel approach instead. And finally, the results of some polling and focus group research commissioned by the Economic Mobility Project of the Pew Charitable Trusts. Faith in American specialness looks unshaken by the current crisis. Despite that crisis, almost one in five Americans, 79% to be precise, believes that it's still possible to get ahead in this economy. Nearly three-quarters, 72%, think they'll be better off in 10 years. African Americans are actually more optimistic than Hispanics, who are in turn more optimistic than whites. How about that? And almost two in three Americans, 62%, think their kids will be better off than they are. by a 50-point margin, 71 to 21, Americans think that personal attributes, like hard work, are more important to mobility than external conditions, like the state of the economy. And only a small minority, about 15%, believes that race and gender have significant impacts on mobility. By a 10-point margin, 46 to 36, Americans think that government hurts mobility more than it helps. And by another 50-point margin, 71 to 21, Americans think it's more important to give people opportunity than it is to reduce inequality. Many of these beliefs are at odds with the facts. Only about 1 in 3 Americans does better than his or her parents on the economic ladder. And race and gender are extremely important influences on outcomes. But these are bedrock beliefs we're talking about, and factual refutation alone won't change them very easily. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about mindful economics. And that's some of the third movement of Beethoven's Sonata No. 26 for piano, Les Adieux, performed by the great Alfred Brendel. And we're now joined on the line by Joel Magnusson, who teaches economics out in Portland, Oregon, and is the author of a relatively new book, Mindful Economics, which is published by Seven Stories Press. Welcome to Behind the News, Joel.
Thank you, Doug. Nice to be with you.
And just a word about the history of this book. You first published a version of this yourself, and then Seven Stories liked it so much they published it officially, right?
That's correct, yeah.
And I should disclose, in the interest of disclosure, that I have a blurb in the back of this book, which I say, an excellent guide to one of the most deliberately mystified areas of human endeavor. If you ever wondered what all those words and concepts mean, this is the book to turn to, and meant every word of that.
Thank you.
So, Joel, mindful economics, I realize that is a phrase or a term that comes out of Buddhism, but are you also implying that the conventional sort is rather mindless?
Well, it's more like it's confused and indirect, sort of lacking a real vision about how to achieve the things that are really important to people. And so I use the term mindful in a way kind of metaphorically in the book about how to get more focused and clear-headed about achieving certain goals, democratic sustainability, justice, stability, those kinds of things. So, you know, our current system seems to be actually moving further and further away from those types of goals.
Yeah, and you wrote this book in more or less good times. Would you have written it any differently now?
Not really. I certainly have a lot more grist for the mill as far as our financial and banking system goes. But I wrote about some of that stuff. Sort of outlining the history of how these crises come about, and in some ways, this is what we're experiencing now is something that's been sort of repeated historically for about 400 years. So it's really not anything substantially new. I mean, there's always a new dimension to these things. But
and we're speaking on the day that Bernie Madoff went off to jail. So, I guess...
Well, and the Dow jumped up back over 7,000. So,
yeah, happy days are here again, huh?
Yeah, I guess it's all over now.
You read a lot at the beginning of the book about the central institution of our economy and, in many ways, the central institution of our social life, the corporation.
Right.
Tell us how that thing, which now seems such a natural part of our life, how it came into existence.
Well, there's, you know, I mentioned 400 years. And, you know, if you go back historically to, say, the early 17th century, that there were monarchs that were really interested in aggregating and pulling together large amounts of money, gold and silver and other types of money that they could use to build their nation states, their armada, their shipbuilding industry, etc. And so these joint stock companies then were formed as crown monopolies, as a sort of prototype to the modern corporation. And the overlying purpose there was to pull together as much financial resources as possible from a very widely dispersed group of investors. And, you know, it just turned out to be a very expedient way to raise a lot of capital. And so the history of the corporation is very much at the center of the history of capitalism itself, because the corporation is really the vehicle through which capitalism has gone through its various stages of evolution over the last 400 years.
But the corporation is obviously a very powerful entity, economically and politically as well. But you know, most mainstream economics, there's not that much attention paid to corporate actors. Is there? It's just all these almost, you know, atomistic, individualistic agents with no power.
That's correct. That's right. And it's, you know, in fact, in most textbooks, economics textbooks, structures of power don't even seem to exist. So, in fact, when these corporations or joint stock companies were formed, they were instruments of power. They were extensions of the power of monarchs, and they were used as instruments of colonization and so on. And so they always have been structures of power.
But they didn't really emerge in the U.S. in a big way until the turn of the last century, right? So the 19th century, we had small proprietorships, capitalists, as we might think of them. How did things change with the development of the stockholder-owned, professionally managed corporation?
Well, the second half of the 19th century that we see corporations rise to significant heights of power and control. Part of it was technological, you know, with the development of the railroads and the railroad monopolies. Part of it was financial, with J.P. Morgan stitching together this financial empire from coast to coast. Part of it was institutional, with you know, the Supreme Court, under somewhat dubious, questionable circumstances, had established a precedent that corporations were persons in the eyes of the law, you know, corporate personhood. So there were all these sort of technological, financial, and institutional developments that sort of came together in the latter half of the 19th century, and then out of that came Standard Oil Company and, Carnegie Steel and the sugar trusts and the tobacco trusts and all of the big monopolies that then sort of evolved into what we see today, which is still J.P. Morgan Chase, General Motors, and AT&T, and so on. So it was at that time in the 19th century that the conditions were ripe for these companies to come and dominate and control markets and monopolize and control government institutions and so on. And, you know, they've been doing pretty much the same thing ever since.
And at the same time the corporation came into existence, the stock market also arose to great prominence. What's the relation between the stock market and the corporation?
Well, of course, the stock markets and bond markets and commodities markets were established as institutions at the same time as joint stock companies or corporations were being established, because if you want to sell shares to capitalize or you want to sell bonds to capitalize a corporation, that you have to have the institutions to facilitate the selling and trading of those instruments. So, one of the things that I write about in Mindful Economics is the history of financial market instability and And one of the things that stands out in that history is that wherever you see those institutions being developed that are market exchanges that are designed to pull money from a broad base of the investor population, where you see that, you also see these sort of wild boom and bust speculative crises follow like a dark shadow.
Yeah, there's nothing new about any of this.
No, although,
given our historical amnesia, we also often think that it is. I'm speaking with Joel Magnuson, who is the author of the book Mindful Economics, recently published by Seven Stories Press. And in a lot of conventional thinking, the market and the state are opposed. They're different things, often in opposition to each other. Do you agree with that analysis?
No. The market system, as we've come to experience it, was as much a government creation as it was created by entrepreneurs. And, there's a great economic historian, Carl Polanyi, wrote a book. It's called The Great Transformation. That's essentially what he writes about in that book, is the emergence in the Great Transformation, is this emergence of the market system. And the market system, particularly, he's focusing on in Britain, but to a lesser extent here in North America. But the process was through a succession of government institutional development that actually made the market system come into being. Prior to these institutional developments, again, by governments, there was no labor markets, no wage labor markets. There were no capital markets, no markets for real estate and for land. And, there's always been markets for finished products that go back, as far back in history as you want to go. But the market system was really a system of tying together the product markets with resource markets to create sort of a full spectrum of markets. And that's something that has never been free in terms of government control or other forms of institutional control, and was actually created by governments.
As I recall, Polanyi, he writes about the development of the idea of a self-regulating market as some sort of institution separate from society, rather than markets being embedded in the larger society.
Right. At some point, the ideology is that society becomes sort of embedded in a market system rather than the other way around, that markets are an institution that would be embedded in society.
Now, in a lot of popular discourse and even in professional economic discourse, there's an idea of even if we don't achieve a perfect degree of laissez-faire, that is that kind of self-regulating market that Polanyi was talking about, we aspire towards it. Maybe not you and me, but certainly the folks down at the street at the New York Stock Exchange and the faculty of MIT and Harvard certainly aspire to it. Is there such a thing as a laissez-faire economy?
I don't think so. I think that's really more of a myth than a reality. And if you really think about how these companies operate, the dominant institutions, how they operate, I mean, they're always more interested in controlling markets, keeping out competition. The pharmaceutical industry is always interested in maintaining patents, generic drug manufacturers out of their markets. And this has always been the case. Where they sort of bring up this laissez-faire free market ideology is mostly in the sense where they don't want government controls on things like labor laws or environmental laws or controls on how they use their resources or controls on how they make their investments or controls on international capital flows. So when it suits their interests, then these companies, these dominant corporate institutions will bring up, well, this is a free market system and we really need to be committed to that. But then when it's not in their interests, then, of course, they turn to government support or some other kind of institutional control. And, you know, because it's unstable or, you know, this is a crisis that we've never seen this kind of thing before. And, they, you know, we have this really kind of odd relationship with that ideology, you know, that these same companies that have been pushing for the deregulation of markets like these banks, for example, they got a lot of deregulation. You know, they repealed a lot of the provisions in Glass-Steagall and so on. And then, you know, when things started to go bad, then they turned around and say, well, you know, we're all socialists now.
Yeah, they want a few $100 billion from the Treasury to keep from going under.
Right, and that in itself is not a new thing. I mean, this is yet just another variation of that same theme, you know, this pattern where businesses who are on the inside of a particular market are pushing for the deregulation of that market because they know that they'll be able to dominate it once the regulations are removed, like Enron. And then inevitably, once the deregulation process, you know, is complete and implemented, then certain problems start to emerge, certain instabilities start to emerge, and then we all have to sort of stand back and make some solemn pronouncements about stability and saving jobs, and these are too big to fail, and so we have no choice now but to have government step in and bail them out.
And of course, it's only when they're in trouble. When they're having good times, they can do pretty much what they want to.
That's right. That's right. You know, and I find it really interesting also that, you know, Robert Rubin was just again and again sort of one of the people that was being interviewed, you know, at this time in this banking crisis, but also about 10 years ago with the East Asian crisis, and then a few years before that, the crisis in Mexico and with the peso down there. And I found it really interesting that in each time there was this crisis, he repeated the same thing. Wow, we've never seen anything like this before. So it's, you know, I think that's part of the process, is that there's this sort of pretense to being shocked. And I think Alan Greenspan said something to that effect when he was testifying for Congress.
You know? Well, in breaking news today, Jack Welch, the former chair of GE, widely revered in the business world,
right,
and often named as the creator of the modern cult of shareholder value, based on a speech he gave back in 1981, saying it was all about raising profits and raising stock prices, and that's all that corporations should worry about. Well, he said, oh, that's kind of a dumb idea, in an interview with the Financial Times, the FT put on its website today, Thursday. So, you know, we have Greenspan doubting the wisdom of the philosophy he learned at the feet of Ayn Rand, and now we have Jack Welch renouncing his own philosophy of maximizing shareholder value. So,
did he renounce his philosophy of how CEOs of these big corporations deserve their compensation? Because I know he was a strong advocate of that as well.
Well, he actually said now corporations have to worry about other things than shareholders, including like customers and employees. We're not looking to Jack Welch to lead a social revolution, but it's amazing to hear this guy at least having some second thoughts about an economic structure he had no small part in creating. But here we are. These are funny times.
Yeah, that certainly is a twist, because again and again, always these CEOs of these companies, whether it's ExxonMobil or pharmaceutical companies or whatever, they always say the same thing. Well, we have a company to run, we have a fiduciary responsibility to our shareholders, and so we're going to do what's in the best interest of our shareholders over the long run. And to some degree, I think that there is a kind of legal responsibility for them to do that. But
that is the way the system is set up. It's not like they're making this up.
No, that's right. And that's why I was, you know, when I was talking earlier about the history of the corporation and the history of capitalism are one and the same, because that kind of profitability, you know, profit maximization ideology that is sort of built into the bylaws of a corporation, well, it just fits with capitalist ideology perfectly.
All right. Since I usually have the bad habit of waiting for the last 2 minutes to ask the "what is to be done" question, but I'll budget 5 minutes for that this time, since that's an important portion of your book.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So,
minutes.
Yes. Well, let's start with here we are in the midst of this financial economic crisis. At least a possibility that people are going to question the received wisdom of the system. What do you tell them? What are there different principles for organizing an economy? You know, we've heard so much that this is the only way. There is no alternative.
Right.
The Soviet Union failed. All kinds of collective action in the economic realm are doomed to failure, just like the Soviet Union. What do you say to that?
Well, it's one of the things, at least in the context of capitalism versus socialism and that sort of thing, is I'm really, in mindful economics and in the talks that I do now, I'm really trying to push the discourse out of that duopoly, you know, that we only have either the capitalist system that exists today in the Anglo-American world, or there's this sort of state socialist system of the Soviet Union or North Korea or something. And I think it's time that we move beyond that dichotomy and start envisioning that there are other possibilities, that it's not just one or the other. I also think that people are very reluctant to talk about capitalism because they're very reticent, you know, that their career is going to be affected if they come across as sounding too radical or, you know, that sort of thing. But yet, when people get down and really start talking about what's wrong, the instabilities, the unfairness, the ecological destructiveness that they're all opposed to, then what they're really saying is that they're opposed to some very fundamental aspects of capitalism, but they just can't seem to bring themselves to say the word. And I understand this, but it just kind of strikes me as odd. You know, it's sort of like an abolitionist who just can't seem to get himself to say the word slavery, you know. But, you know, that said, I think that what is really kind of, you know, the central problem for us is that so much of our capitalist system now is highly, highly centralized, and it's becoming even more so just like this week now with this merger of the pharmaceutical companies, and you know this last year the mergers of these bank companies like Merrill Lynch and Bank of America and so on. So this kind of centralization was really at the center of this problem in the first place. You know, when you have a handful of banks that make some bad decisions, then those banks dominate 60% of the industry, then they're going to drag the rest of the industry and probably the rest of the economy or the global economy down with them. So one of the things that I've been working on and talking about is moving away from that highly centralized system to a much more decentralized system where economies are becoming more and more focused on fostering local and regional institutions. And I think this is in part going to be necessary just because energy costs are going to make it increasingly difficult to move resources around the world like we've been doing in the past under this more centralized system. But also, I think that it allows for communities to sort of demand more democratic accountability of the businesses that are doing business in their areas, in their communities. So, and I think that this is also nothing new, that in Mindful Economics I write a lot about the history of institutional development, and this is really what people have always done when they began to see clearly that the large centralized dominant institutions in society are no longer the stewards of their interest. Then they start developing their own at a local level. And so I think that it's, you know, there are certainly some problems around that. I know you and I have talked about this before, but you know, at the same time, I think that it, at least it's a place to start. You know, because when somebody gets laid off, you know, that's a local thing. It's the company in their town or their neighborhood. You know, the decision may have been made somewhere else, but you know, these crises in many ways are local.
You know, actually, it occurs to me I should have do a whole show on these sorts of questions, because we've just run out of time, and it's very frustrating. So I think I need to convene a roundtable of people to talk about these sorts of the what is to be done kinds of questions, which I don't really pay enough attention to. Spend too much time analyzing the pathological system that exists, and not enough talking about what could be. So you've inspired me to that. Let's do that sometime soon.
I'd love to.
Thank you for joining us.
I've
been speaking with Joel Magnuson, who is the author of Mindful Economics, How the U.S. Economy Works, Why It Matters, and How It Could Be Different, published by Seven Stories Press. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about student debt. And that's some of Black Hearted Love, new from P.J. Harvey and John Parrish. I think the full album due out pretty soon. That song released a little ahead of time. And we're now joined by Aurora Menengello and Serge Bakalian, who are putting together a film on student debt. Default is the working title of the movie, the student loan documentary. And welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Great to be on.
Great to be on. Hi.
Okay, so first of all, you are still in the early stages of this. You've put together a trailer and need some funding to finish it up, right?
Correct. We've been researching the topic for about a year and a half, and we have a 5-minute trailer which people can look at www.defaultmovie.com, and we're currently raising funds to make a the plan is to make a 20-minute version to take her on campuses and to help educate borrowers, and then eventually to make a feature length.
And again, that URL is Default Movie, all one word, defaultmovie.com. I think a lot of us who aren't students probably don't think all that much about student debt, but my God, it is an enormous problem, isn't it? Give us some idea of the scope of what people graduate with now.
Sure. The average student graduates with $20,000 of debt. That's an average. If we look at more specific numbers, for example, at private, nonprofit, four-year institutions, 73.9% of graduating seniors have education debt. And of these borrowers, one-fourth have at least $28,222 in student loans, and 10% have student debt of $40,000 or more.
So what does that do with you? What does that do to you when you graduate? It limits your options, doesn't it?
Well, one thing that we've seen with people in our generation and younger and even older, you know, if you go to school in your 30s or 40s, is that the first thing that happens when you graduate is that you cannot necessarily pick the career you want. Sometimes after graduating from college, you have to take an entry-level job that won't pay you much, and in certain fields, you will never make a lot of money. And some people cannot continue in the career they've chosen because they have to make such hefty payments straight out of college.
And this definitely, you know, one of the larger issues here is that this coincides with Education has gotten so much more expensive. I mean, the UC system, for example, here in California, they've, for the past 10 years, or 8 years, excuse me, they've raised tuition. And just across the country, education is getting more expensive. The federal government has been cutting funding, so more and more students are having to take private student loans. And private student loans are administered by corporations, for-profit corporations. And, you know, we're very familiar with what that leads to. So, and that's a big problem.
So, for example, somebody graduating from law school can't go into public interest law. They've got to go and, make as much money as possible, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We're also seeing physicians who are making choices to, go into selective surgery or plastic surgery, because they're not going to be able to do family practice.
Now, I had a friend who went to business school who paid off his MBA loans with his first year's bonus, but that's not an option available to most of us, is it?
I think there are a lot of people out there that can pay their student loans, and that's great. The problem is when something unexpected happens in life, like people might get sick, or their parents might get sick, or a family member, and they need to help themselves or somebody else. They don't finish their degree. They find out, halfway through law school that law is not really what they're cut out for, but they still have to pay their loans. They cannot get the job they thought they would get after graduating. You know, law school, I'm glad you brought it up, because law students are encouraged to borrow a really high amount of money. And the average lawyer doesn't make that much money. And a lot of law students don't even practice. So they're actually one category where they have really high rates of default on their loans, because the expectations are very high compared to the realities for the majority of them.
Of course, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are in the news, but they have a cousin or a sister named Sally Mae. Tell us about Sally Mae.
Well, Sally Mae is interesting because they're actually a removed cousin of Freddie Mac. Most people think that Sally Mae is actually part of the government or sort of a quasi-entity of the government.
And that stands for Student Loan Marketing Association, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
But they actually are a for-profit corporation. And they've just, you look at their profit history, especially in the last decade, it's enormous. And yet, they profit. One of the secrets about Sally Mae is that they profit more if a student actually defaults on their loans. That's one of the little dirty secrets about what they do.
Well, tell us about their business model. What do they do in the first place?
Let me jump in here. So Sally Mae is one of the for-profit companies. There's others, they're not the only one. They're just the biggest one, where they have permission from the government to administer loans that come from the federal government. So when you borrow from Sally Mae or Citibank or other companies like that, you might be getting a federal loan, which means your funds are subsidized and guaranteed by the federal government, or you might get a private loan. And a private loan is pretty much like a credit card kind of unsecured loan. Your rate is variable. You don't have the same protections you have with a credit card. But you're stuck with the same kind of interest and varying interest. So a lot of what happens with students is that they got, let's say 2, 3, 4, 5 loans from Sally Mae or Citibank or any of these companies, and they don't even realize which ones of these loans have a low interest rate and which ones of these loans are more like a credit card loan. And that's one of the problems.
Yeah, do students really fully understand what they're getting into when they borrow all this money? Is it disclosed to them just what they're going to pay when they get out of college or graduate school?
It's not. We read a great article from the LA Times by Casey Christoph, and on December 27, they published this great article where they borrowed the Social Security number of an 18-year-old and contacted three private student loan lenders. And none of these companies would upfront disclose interest rate and terms of the loans. And it took a lot of the LA Times journalists calling and asking to get some information, and still they wouldn't disclose how much the student would pay at the end of the payment in 10 years, in 15 years. They wouldn't have a fixed rate. They only have variable rates, and they would always say, well, you know, terms are subject to change. Things may change after you graduate and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, so, if you were to go, if you were to get a mortgage, you have a scheduled payment. You know, the day after you get your mortgage, you get sort of this packet that outlines for the next 30 or 40 years of your loan of how much you owe and when you owe it. When you do that with these private student loans, you don't get that. And, you know, you might see there's a change in your credit score, for example, or something happens, or you're late on a payment, and suddenly you see all these extra interests and fees that get applied to your loan. And, you know, we have story after story of borrowers who, for a number of reasons, they've just found out one day that their interest rates have ballooned. I mean, we have stories of people with interest rates in the 25, 26% range. I mean, that's outrageous.
That's higher than a credit card, even.
Well, oh, absolutely. I mean, you can go. You should have put your tuition on your credit card. At least you might have earned air miles off of it.
I'm speaking with, that's the voice of Serge Bakalian, and along with him, Aurora Menengello, who are putting together a movie, Default, on the problem of student debt. And I was amazed from watching your trailer and reading your website that student loans are not covered by a lot of the protections, consumer protections, other forms of consumer credit are. Not that those are always great, but bankruptcy, disclosure, et cetera. Tell us about just how naked people are when they borrow student loan debt.
Well, there basically is no bankruptcy protection. It's extremely difficult to get bankruptcy. It's extremely difficult to get your loans discharged through bankruptcy. And this is true for government loans, and it's been like that for a long time. But it's also true since 2005 for private loans that, again, we're talking about variable rates that can go up to 25-26%. So you imagine somebody that gets out of school with $50,000 debt at 25%, and you can imagine how hard it is to pay back. Also, you can only consolidate once, and this becomes very complicated because certain loans will have certain protections, and other loans don't have the same protections, they have different protections. So it becomes extremely confusing for people, and they don't even know which loans they can get help from and which loans they cannot. But one thing that's a problem is that most of the time you can only consolidate once. So if you consolidate your loans and then, you know, later on there's the interest rate goes down, well, you can't get out of that anymore. You're stuck with the one-time consolidation.
And you can't even get out of it if you die necessarily, right?
In certain cases, that's true. And, you know, the spouse or the parents somebody has to pay back. Yes. I would like to recommend that people check out two websites that are, you know, where there's experts on these topics that can give much more specific information on the different types of loans. And one is the Project on Student Debt, and it's projectonstudentdebt.org. And the other one is studentloanborrowerassistance.org. And both of these places have legal experts and advocacy experts that really take a long time to write down every specific case and, you know, discuss specific laws. Even for us, in a year and a half of research, it's been so hard to find information and to sometimes understand. It takes a lot of prior knowledge.
It's egregious to think that these corporations expect 17 and 18 year olds right out of high school with sort of wide eyed dreams of going to college and entering a successful career for them to understand the fine print.
Yeah, as I recall my college self, I didn't really fully understand what it was going to be like to be a grown-up, what it would mean to have to pay the bills and what what debt would mean. It just didn't make it. I was lucky enough to have parents who could pay my way through college. I didn't have any debt when I graduated, but many of my fellow students did. Like I said, I just really don't think I fully could have understood. I couldn't have entered into the contract as a fully informed borrower.
Well, you know, the cost of college also has risen dramatically in the past 10 years. For example, 4 years at a public university, including room and board, cost now an average of $57,000. And the average tab for a private university is $136,000.
Now, the gap between those two is not really as large as you might think it should be for a public university.
Right.
Sure, but if you think about it, in 4 years, you're going to spend $136,000 for tuition or $60,000. That's, you know, that's including room and board, but still, that's a lot of money. A lot of people after they graduate, like your typical teacher in Alabama, makes $28,000 a year when they start teaching. And if the average debt around the country is $20,000 per student, so you're already there. You're a teacher, and I don't know how you can pay your student loan back.
I was amazed, though, when you say that the total volume of student debt outstanding is about $80 billion. By the standards of the U.S. financial markets, that's not a lot of money, really. But it's an enormous burden to the people who are involved.
Right, but what's happening is that you have this huge class of you know, new graduates who enter the job market, or at least are looking for jobs, and they already enter it at a disadvantage. And, you know, we're not saying that people who borrow money should not be responsible to pay it back. But to pay back 4 or 5 times of what you borrowed is outrageous.
The point I was trying to get to there was that $80 billion is not a lot of money by the standards of the U.S. financial markets. Okay. It's a terrible burden to the people who graduate with the debt. But it would not cost us very much as a society to make tuition reasonable or even free. I mean, these are not large sums for the U.S. economy to manage, yet we instead choose to burden young people with tremendous debts at the beginning of their professional lives.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Absolutely right.
Well, I think one thing that's very important to think about is the wider effect of this debt on the rest of society, because it's not just the people that take the loans that are affected by it. But the same people might not spend money on, for example, goods and be part of the economy as much. They'll be still paying their loans instead of maybe contributing. They cannot work in the jobs they want. They cannot save for their children to pay for their college education. So it becomes kind of a spiral. And the younger the students, now the younger generations, the more they're borrowing, and the more percentage, a larger percentage of them is borrowing.
All right, well, tell us what you, we only have a couple minutes left, but tell us what you want to do, if you, assuming that you can raise the money and don't have to run up your credit cards to do it. what are you looking to do? You do a lot of interviews and talk to people who are in this kind of situation?
Yeah, I mean, the focus of the film is really going to be about sort of the people affected by the problem. But, you know, our goal is really to just help have people ask the questions of, like, what's going on, to help to educate them, to help educate people who have the loans currently to see what situation are they in. I mean, we go from campus to campus and ask students, well, is your loan subsidized, unsubsidized? Is it through the federal government? Is it private? What's the interest rate? What's your grace period? And it's incredible. People across the board do not know. They don't have all the information. And that's a very scary prospect. And that's what we want to do with the film. We really want to help raise awareness of the problem and, you know, and hopefully affect change. Because it also, especially with these private loans, there are rules on the book that can help regulate it. But unfortunately, it's not enforced. And there's many reasons for that. But, you know, we just would want some of these laws enforced or strengthened.
And as we're speaking on the TV, I'm seeing a report on New York City's billionaires. We have the top five together are worth $60 billion. So we could take all their money and pay off almost all the student debt in the United States, starting with our mayor, worth $16 billion, one-fifth of the total. It's amazing. Well, thanks to both of you, and good luck in completing the film. I've been speaking with Aurora Benigno and Serge Bakalian, who are together putting together a film, a documentary called Default, the student loan documentary. And you can check out their work in progress at the website defaultmovie.com, defaultmovie.com. Thanks to both of you, and good luck.
Thank you very much for having us on.
And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. And I will be back next week. And let's go out with this, putting together two artists who I've played on the past couple of weeks. One, Telepathy. The other, Lauren Flax. This is Lauren Flax's remix of Telepathy's song, So Fine. All right. Till next week. Bye.